Let's head back to the Old Testament this morning. 1 Kings chapter 12 is where we'll be working. 1 Kings chapter 12. While you're going there, let me mention two things to you. Friday begins our men's weekend. I don't know, Adam, how many times have we tried to get that in this year? I think this may be the third time. That is exactly right. COVID has wreaked havoc with men's weekend this year. But finally on Friday, we're going to make it. Bubba Garner's going to be with us. So guys, Friday, Saturday, and on Sunday, Bubba's going to speak with us in the morning. That's this coming weekend, so mark that down. And while you're working on your schedule, November 5 through 7, mark that down too. That is our weekend in the Word. Going to have some preaching and some series of classes on Saturday, special events on Sunday. You want to make sure you've cleared your schedule so that you can be part of all that. It's going to be an exciting weekend of study. That's November 5, 6, and 7. For this morning, we're in 1 Kings chapter 12, and while you're looking at that text, let's set the context just a little bit for where we'll be working. First of all, Solomon has died, and his son Rehoboam is now stepping up to ascend the throne and become king in his place, expecting to rule over the nation that his father had led. However, 10 of the tribes in the north were having nothing to do with that. They did not want Rehoboam as their king. They chose instead Jeroboam and rebelled against Rehoboam. And from that day, the nation is split into two parts, Israel in the north, Judah in the south. And that's how things would remain throughout the rest of their history until their enemies come and take them off into captivity. And so that's where we are in 1 Kings chapter 12. Jeroboam is going to lead this new nation in the north, Israel. Appreciate that he is in a very delicate situation. He has just come to power over a new nation, and to his south, he has an enemy that would like nothing better than to take advantage of any kind of stumble on his part to come back and reunite the nation. And so he quickly begins at the end of chapter 12 to take some steps to shore up his position. In verse 25, we're told that he fortifies a couple of cities. That makes sense. But there is still a concern that he has that he fears will destabilize his reign in the north. And he talks at length about that here at the end of chapter 12. The hub of the nation spiritually is still in Jerusalem, in the south. Remember that. And so, at regular intervals, his people are going to be required by law to go back down to Jerusalem to worship. And so in his mind, Jeroboam sees how that's going to work out. I'm picking up in verse 26. Are you there? This is 1 Kings 12, verse 26. Jeroboam said in his heart, "Now the kingdom will return to the house of David. If this people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will return to their Lord, even to Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, king of Judah." Do you see it there? These people are going to start going home for the holiday, and they're going to start feeling bad about their divided nation, and this religious unity they share in Jerusalem will make them want to get back together. And if that happens, Jeroboam realizes, I will be the guy without a chair at the table. What they're going to do with me is what they did to all guys who wind up being dethroned. They just don't retire. They kill them. And he sees that as what is coming for him. Now, it's important to pause here and make a point. From back in chapter 11, Jeroboam had no reason to fear that that would happen. Zero. Because when God met with him in chapter 11, by the way, all of this took place by the hand of God. God told him in chapter 11, "Look, if you will be faithful to me and walk in my ways, I will build for you an enduring house. What does that mean? If you'll just do right, Jeroboam, your kingdom will thrive. You don't have anything to fear from Rehoboam in the south. You don't have to fear the nation coming back together because this has been my work anyway. You just trust me and you will be all right. So the real issue here is not what would the people do if they went back and worshiped in Jerusalem. God had already settled that. The real issue is, would Jeroboam believe God? Would he trust him and do what he said? Don't miss that that underlies everything going on here. The real issue is, would Jeroboam trust God? And the answer is that he wouldn't. He was still worried about this. And so he begins to take some steps to address the thing that he fears. Look at verse 28. So the king consulted and made two golden calves. And he said one, and he said to them, "It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, that brought you up from the land of Egypt." Verse 29. He set one in Bethel, and another he put in Dan. Verse 31. And he made houses on high places, and made priests from among all the people who were not of the sons of Levi. Jeroboam instituted a feast in the eighth month of the 15th day of the month, like the feast which is in Judah. And he went up to the altar, thus he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves which he had made. And he stationed in Bethel the priest of the high places which he had made. Then he went up to the altar which he had made in Bethel on the 15th day of the eighth month, even in the month which he had devised in his own heart. And he instituted a feast for the sons of Israel, and he went up to the altar to burn incense. One of the interesting things you can do with this text is go back and mark all the places where it says this is what he did and where he went and what he instituted and set up. In fact, I love in verse 33, it's made emphatically. The point is that this is what he devised in his own heart. So he's not listening to God. None of this involved consultation with God or what God's will was. This is all Jeroboam taking some really shrewd steps to deal with this problem. I think he imagines he's killed two birds with one stone here. I've satisfied the people's need for worship, but they're doing it at home. They're not going back to Jerusalem. And so while this served his political objectives, did you notice that I missed verse 30? I passed right over that. So let's go back and grab it now. So he's doing all of this. The text says in verse 30, now this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. God was not pleased with it. In fact, in trying to preserve the nation he wanted to lead, Jeroboam had actually, with this act, set in motion the thing that would ultimately destroy the nation. It's interesting that if you go forward from here and read the rest of the history of the Northern Empire, we're told king after king after king walked in the sin of Jeroboam, with the sin with which he made Israel to sin. That is repeated over and over again until we get to 2 Kings. Will you go here with me? 2 Kings 17, when finally Assyria is brought as the rod of God's anger to punish his people. But I want you to notice that when we're told why Israel fell and was taken captive by their enemies, this is for 2 Kings 17. Look at verse 21. Let's talk about what God had done. When he had torn Israel from the house of David, they made Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, king. And so here at the end of the northern kingdom, they're looking back to the beginning, back when Jeroboam came king, back to 1 Kings 12. I want you to notice what he says. Then Jeroboam drove Israel away from following the Lord and made them commit a great sin. The sons of Israel walked in the sins of Jeroboam, which he did, and they did not depart from them until the Lord removed Israel from his sight, as he had spoken through all his servants the prophets. So Israel was carried away into exile from their own land to Assyria until this day. Do you see it? Here at the very end of their story, What we're told is that their problems were rooted back at the very beginning of this nation's history with Jeroboam's decision that he would not trust God, that he would go out on his own and do his thing and as a result make Israel sin a great sin. Jeroboam's great solution to what he saw as his greatest threat actually turned out to be his greatest blunder that ultimately destroyed the nation. You see it? What happened here? He didn't trust God. He did his own thing, and he made a mess. And it's a problem, brothers and sisters, as old as Adam and Eve. When you start thinking about it, that pattern of not trusting God and going out on your own and making a mess, how many times is that repeated? How many stories could we cite? It's what Adam and Eve did in the garden. They didn't trust God. They didn't do what he said. They made a mess. How about Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus chapter 10? How about David when he decided to move the ark of God in a new and revelationary way? Over and over again, the story is repeated. And not just in the Old Testament. When we move on to the new covenant, look at Galatians chapter 1. When we move on to the new covenant, we find the same problem. Galatians 1 and verse number 6. Paul would say, I am amazed, speaking to early disciples, I am amazed that you are so quickly deserting him who called you by the grace of Christ for a different gospel. Which is really not another, only there are some who are disturbing you who want to distort the gospel of Christ. What's happening? People are going out of their own. They're not trusting God. They're doing their own thing, and they're making a mess. And it has serious consequences in verse 8. In verse 8, Paul says, but even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to that which we have preached to you, he is to be accursed. So it's serious business. And you know why I'm saying all of this, right? Because it was a problem under the Old Covenant, and we see it a problem among the New Testament disciples, should we really not anticipate that we may struggle with this as well? I think we are at risk too, because we live in a time where there are all kinds of voices that call us to listen to a different gospel. Can you hear them? Maybe times when those other voices are appealing. They offer new worship forms that are exciting and teaching a message that is less restrictive. And maybe lets me do things I always really wanted to do anyway. And they're able to draw these huge and enthusiastic crowds. I think the devil knows, brothers and sisters, that there are some of us that will never be persuaded to be atheists. We just need to realize that atheism is not the only path that leads away from God. And that the devil always tries to get us to hear a different gospel. And so I think Jeroboam's story helps to expose that danger for us. And that there are some things, some lessons, that in our time, when our struggle with this, that I think we can learn from his story. I would like to share three with you this morning and invite you to consider them with me. Let's begin with this. Number one, I think one of the things we learn from this story is that false religion really exists. You're stunned to see that on the slide, right? New revolutionary. Never thought about that before, right? I am amazed at some things like I feel like I need to get up and say when I preach. But I feel like I need to say that when I get up and preach, that false religion is really a thing. It really exists. And I hope everyone in the audience is saying, move on to point two. We've got that. I hope we do, because we live in a culture where people don't get that. It's very common for people to say today, and listen, in a very Oprah-esque fashion, everybody has their own path to God, right? You've heard this before? Everybody kind of finds their own way. And we need to be open and receptive to whatever path people choose to find to God. And so people may wear different religious names and as a result of that embrace different kinds of worship and different teaching, maybe even contradictory teaching. But that's all okay, because all it means is everybody's kind of finding their way. Heard that? In fact, there are folks today who get really exasperated. I've encountered them about any kind of discussion about religious differences. Even teachings that are contradictory. Real exasperated with all of that because in their minds, that's also unnecessary. Why are we even talking about such things? Listen, everyone ought to be able to find their way. And so the idea of false religion, if it even exists in some people's mind, we reserve that for groups like, well, the Branch Davidians out in Waco. Maybe that's a false religion, but other than that, everyone's finding their way to God. Though I don't understand why the Branch Davidians don't get to do that too. No objective basis for that. It's just kind of what folks say. And so I think in our culture, if Jeroboam had been doing his thing today, I think a lot of folks would have given him a thumbs up. So that's good. Israel is finding their way to God. It wasn't God's assessment of this. Again, if you'll go back to 1 Kings chapter 12 and you look at verse 30, God calls it sin. It's not hard to figure out why. In fact, there are just some overt things in the text here at the end of chapter 12 where we see what the problem is. For example, God had prohibited the use of images. That's like a Ten Commandment thing. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 4. Don't make any images like the one Jeroboam said at Dan and Bethel. God said, don't do that. He did. And then there's the whole issue of the priest. Did you notice that? Jeroboam came along and said, rather than just choosing from one tribe, we'll take priests. We'll take priests from any tribe. Everybody can be a priest. Well, that sounds more open, doesn't it? More inclusive to let everybody be part of that. I think to a lot of folks, what he did would have seemed just like some minor tweaks. I mean, they are still worshiping Jehovah. It's not like he had introduced Baal worship in Israel. And they're still doing the kind of stuff they did in Jerusalem. In fact, that point is made here at the end of chapter 12. What we're doing looks a lot like what we used to do. There are still altars and sacrifice. Verse 32 says there was a feast day that looked like the one in Jerusalem. Surely God wouldn't care if they just tweaked things a little. But he did. In fact, if we really wanted to go on for a while this morning, we could jump into chapter 13 where God sends his prophet to go cry out against these images that Jeroboam had set up. He wasn't pleased at all. And so a couple of things I think you and I need to take away from that in a very practical way. Number one, folks, because false religion exists and there can be false teaching and vain worship, because all of that is true, it matters what we do when we come together. It matters what we do. It matters what kind of things we do when we worship. And it matters what is taught from this pulpit and in these classrooms. And we come together to work. It matters what kind of work we do. We just can't worship in any way. We can't just teach anything. We can't just do any work. God was not pleased with Jeroboam. How could we think that we can go out on our own and God would be pleased with us too? And so, because false teaching is a thing, because worship can be vain, it matters what we do. And so, second thought, add to that then, is this. If that is so, if it matters what we do, we need to listen to God. We need to do what Jeroboam didn't do. We need to trust him enough to let him guide us in what we do. And so, I think about King David. After he tried to move the ark on the cart. Y'all remember the story, the Uzzah story? It's a very interesting statement made in 1 Chronicles 15, 13. Talk about a little detail. Talk about just tweaking a little something. All he did was change the way they moved it, and he made a big fat mess. Somebody died. That's how big the mess was. And as he looks back on that in 1 Kings 15 and verse 13, he says, you know what the problem was? We didn't seek him according to the ordinance. Those are his exact words. What does that mean? We set out to do something to honor God, but we didn't listen to Him about how to do that. And so, as we look at Jeroboam's story and David's story, there's a lesson for us. When we are determined to honor God, can we agree, brothers and sisters, that begins with listening to Him? What He has said about how to do that, to get back to His book and let Him lead us and guide us. That's the only way to ensure that our worship and our work and our teaching truly does honor Him. We need to be concerned about that. Because false religion really is a thing. It really exists. And then a second thing to take away from the story is this, that often convenience is the lure to get people down the wrong path. Think about that for a minute. Convenience is the lure to get us on the wrong path. And so I think about one of the hurdles Jeroboam has to get over in setting up this new system is getting the people to go along with that, right? You would have thought that wouldn't be very easy because they had been doing things the same way in the same place for a long, long time. And all of us over the age of 50 know about being stuck in ruts and curmudgeonly about that, right? You would have think he'd have had some more pushback. How did he sell it to them? Well, if you look back in 1 Kings 12, verse 28, right in the middle of the verse, here's what he says to them. Here's his sales pitch. It is too much for you. It is asking way too much for you guys to all have to pack up and go on that long journey south all the way down to or up to Jerusalem. We can make this easier. Everything you do down there, we can do that right here at home, and you don't have to travel, especially to that rotten city ruled by that king that you don't like. You can stay home. In fact, he sets up two options, right? Some of these suggested that the timing of Jeroboam's new feast had been slightly changed from the one in Jerusalem because it better accommodated the harvesting schedule for northern farmers. If that's so, it's just another example of how he's using convenience to make his case. This is easier for you. And as I pondered that, it occurred to me that that's often the lure that gets people away from the Lord. People are lured away with the offer of convenience. For example, you do realize that it's possible to find a religion today that will be more convenient morally, right? So if you want to practice a homosexual lifestyle, or if you don't like your spouse and you want to dump them and go find somebody else, and you don't want any pushback about that, you do realize that you can find religion today that will accommodate that. That will at least look the other way if they just don't endorse it altogether. It's out there. You can find it. In fact, if you want a place, just generally speaking, that leaves you alone and lets you live your life the way you want to, you can find a place that'll do that. You can find religion today that will be more convenient for your lifestyle. Listen, if you don't like getting up on Sundays and you'd like to go to church just occasionally, like during the holidays, if you want to be a Christmas and Easter Christian, and have nobody hassle you about that. Let me tell you today, there is a church out there for you. You just need to go hunt for it. It's there. In fact, if you want to find a group, doesn't expect anything from you, you can just kind of come in when you choose to and leave when you want to. Nobody's going to talk to you about serving and work and doing things for the Lord. There are places that will accommodate that. And you can find places that will give you what you want in terms of worship. You want to go to a church where the lesson will always be upbeat, never dark, never fuss at you, never make you feel guilty? They're meeting this morning somewhere in Houston. I was studying with a guy one time. He was looking for a church. Church shopping, I think that's the way he described it. And that's how I got to study with him. He visited us one Sunday, and we got a Bible study going. And so one of our studies, he came in and said, I got to tell you about the place I visited last week. So I went in this building, I sat down in the pew, guy in front of me turns around and said, is this your first time here? And he said, yes, first time. I'm looking around. He said, oh, you will love this church. You will love it. There is no guilt here. So if you're looking for that, you don't want anyone to beat you up with the preaching, make you feel bad about what you're doing, you can find that. If you'd like to find a place where you are the focus and the worship is all about keeping you entertained and they're always looking for some new gimmick to enhance the experience for you, they're everywhere. You can find one. We need to be honest about what that is. Work of the enemy to pull us away from Jesus. And the lure is convenience. In response to that, can we just be plain about something this morning? Brothers and sisters, following Jesus is not convenient. It's never been so. In fact, when a person signs on to being a disciple, as Jeff is so fond of saying, what we're doing is agreeing to let Jesus mess with every part of our lives. Luke 9:23, if anyone wishes to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. And I promise you, he's not talking there to just a few schedule, tweaking a few schedule items on the weekend. It's wholesale, new person kind of change. That's the way Paul describes it in Ephesians 4. We become disciples. It's like there's an old man that is killed and put away, and we put on this whole new person. We clothe ourselves with Christ, a new person that looks like Jesus. Sometimes that's really hard. Jesus is going to challenge me to move and change and sacrifice and grow and work and suffer. You want an example about that? Think about the guy writing Ephesians 4, who goes from persecutor to preacher. Think about the radical kinds of changes that happened in the life of the Apostle Paul. And make no mistake, brothers and sisters, it is exactly what he wants to do in your life and mine too. So when we find ourselves being pulled down a path that makes it all easier and more convenient, when that's happening, that probably needs a red flag. That needs to be a red flag for us to stop and say, wait. Maybe that is not the right path. We need to see that, because the last thing we learn from this story is that the consequences of going down that wrong path are devastating. God made clear that he was not pleased with Jeroboam. And yet, in spite of that, think about this. In spite of the fact that God wasn't pleased, every king after him did exactly the same thing. Do you see that? One after another. And who knows how many tens of thousands of people were led astray because of their poor, ungodly leadership. Until the nation fell. Consequences are serious for us too. Last passage I'd like to consider this morning is in Matthew chapter 7, the end of the Sermon on the Mount. Will you go there, Matthew chapter 7? As Jesus wraps up this sermon, he's really calling us to do the very same thing that he called Jeroboam to do. 1 Kings 11. Trust him. To do what he said. And so, in verse 21, as part of that appeal, he says this: not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven will enter. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and in your name cast out demons and in your name perform many miracles? These are not atheists, folks. These are people sitting in the church building on Sunday. These are active religious folks who believe they are serving the Lord, who are told on judgment, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. It's one of the most frightening passages to me in the Bible. Possibility of being very, very religious, yet to be on the wrong path. There's eternity that is hanging in the balance. So in light of that danger, what's the takeaway for me and you? It's that we need to be people of the book, folks. I need to be reading my Bible. I mean, like every day. I need to be in the Word so that I can hear Him. Maybe be on a Bible reading program, like maybe reading Luke and Acts. Are you in on that? And I need to dig deeply. I need to not skim over the tough places, but pause and dig down, even when it's hard, and figure out what the message is that I'm supposed to get here. You know, we're doing it right now on Sunday night in the text talk with Song of Solomon. Maybe the toughest book of the Bible, Jeff, like in the top three anyway, right? And we're not skimming over it. We're digging deep. We're trying to figure it out. Are you part of that? Listen, Bible classes are important because we get an opportunity to sit down with each other and to hear collective ideas and different input as we wrestle with the text and try to figure out what is His will for us. We need to be part of that. We need to get our kids on that. While we're talking about kids, we need to get the book open at home, folks. Bible needs to be open around our house. It needs to be the atmosphere that fills our homes. Our kids need to be growing up learning to be great students of the Word and with great understanding of the will of the Creator for them. And I bet if we polled the crowd this morning and asked, do you think that's important to have that going on at our house? I bet 100% of the people would say, absolutely, that's important. So here's the question, is it happening at your house? Or do my kids know more about swinging a baseball bat or algebra than they do about what God said? Ouch, that was a little starchy. That's important. We need to know the book better than we know anything. Because everything is hanging in the balance on this. Paul warned that God's wrath would be unleashed against those who do not obey the gospel. Jesus said, those who do the will of the Father will enter the kingdom of heaven. Our passion ought to be, above everything else in life, to know Him and to know His will. We should be passionate when we know it about serving Him and honoring Him. It is who we are. It is part of the one thing we do. So one last question. Do I know that I have done what is necessary to be His child? I did not ask you how you feel about your relationship with God. But here's the reality. We can feel okay when we're not. In fact, sometimes we can feel like we're not okay when we really are. So it isn't really about how we feel. Here's what it's about. Do I know that I have done the will of God? And that I am His child. God said, you have to believe in my Son. And you've got to decide that you are going to commit your life to living for Him. And God said, you need to be immersed in water for the forgiveness of your sins. So if you haven't done that, it doesn't matter how you feel. I've got to do what He told me to do. So as we wrap this up today, maybe there's someone that needs to do that. What we want to do is sing a song and make this appeal. Right now is your time. You can make that decision to do the will of God and know that things are right with Him. If that's what your need is, if that's where you are, what we would do is invite you to come down right now. Come down to the front while we stand, while we sing together.